and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with just myself, Jasmine Harrison, and Joe Kirk today. Hello, Joe.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, indeed. there's no Phil today. God knows where he's off gallivanting to now. but we had a good session. I think we made a good go of it between the two of us. Even though it did remind me how difficult it can be to keep up with the chat when there's only two people on a session. But yeah, regardless, I enjoyed it.
Yes, me too. It is very tricky keeping up with the chat at the best of times, and it's even worse, like you said, when there's two of us. But I think we did a pretty good job. I thoroughly enjoyed that session.
You can be the judge of that.
Yes,
listeners.
Yes, absolutely. Please do give us some feedback.
Yeah, we do actually like feedback.
We do, and we think we're doing a good job. So if we're not, please let us know.
Got no idea.
people keep coming back, so we must be doing something.
Yeah,
right.
That's true. But yeah, anyway, to explain, you know, what we went through today. So there were a few news pieces, even though it didn't feel like it at first, you know, when we were prepping for the session. We found a few really good talking points. So, Joe?
Yes. At the start, we broke down Microsoft's latest feature called Recall. Talking through that, weren't we? Kind of trying
to watch, yeah.
Yeah, trying to work out kind of what the risks are and, you know, kind of what the purpose is of it for, and could it possibly be used for employee monitoring as well. And I think that was probably my favorite part of the session, actually kind of breaking down that and kind of having a bit of an open discussion, because it's something I've actually never heard of. So it was almost like a real life scenario for me to kind of talk it through with yourself, Jasmine. So yeah, I really enjoyed that part of the session for me.
Yeah, me too. I think, you know, as we went on, more and more thoughts kept coming to us and more risks. So we went down a little bit of a rabbit hole there, which was good. And then we also spoke about the report that has been issued by the European Data Protection Board's ChatGPT Task Force. So they've been doing an investigation into ChatGPT and OpenAI and have found some talking points. So we spoke about that a little bit. And then the ICO released some guidance on, well, for individuals in, you know, the wake of the general election, and how, you know, different constituencies coming in and changes of MPs might affect individuals and open cases. So we explored that a little bit and then ended on a little debate on a breach that has occurred about a year ago now from Lewisham Council, and whether that should have been reported to the ICO or not. So I think I really enjoyed that part, to be honest. And that's not a, you know, ploy to make you stay till the end, but it was a good one.
Yeah, I agree. And it kind of highlights the kind of complications of being in a role as a DPO and a privacy officer, that things aren't always as straightforward as they seem. And there's, you know, you have to quite a lot of stuff to fully understand, you know, what you need to do in terms of requirements around the law. So yeah, do listen out for that discussion at the end. It's definitely worth a listen.
Yeah, and next week neither of us are going to be here. I don't think that's ever happened since you started, Joe.
No, yeah, you're probably quite right. Yeah, so over a year of where we both get a Friday off, which is nice, I guess. Although I do love doing these, I am looking forward to having a Friday off from prepping.
Yeah, stressful mornings, but no, next week there'll be Phil Brining, I'm sure you're fully aware of who he is by now. And then our service manager Laura is going to be joining us. So she's come from a council, so they're going to be discussing FOIA and FOIA requests. That's Freedom of Information and the Freedom of Information Act. So it'll be a good session, something different, and we hope you enjoy it. But in the meantime, yeah, hope you enjoy this session.
Bit unorthodox, to say the least, as it seems to, I say that every Friday it feels like, but I've only worked 2 days this week because Monday was a bank holiday, and then Tuesday, Wednesday I've been in the process of moving house, I guess you call it. I've moved into a flat.
What else would you call it?
Well, I don't know. I've moved into a flat, haven't I? I don't know. So that's been so stressful, but yeah, it's been a busy 2 days doing that, still not completely done. So that's kind of like my mind's kind of been occupied elsewhere. And then, yeah, so working yesterday and today, it's always a little bit strange coming back, isn't it, after a few days off, to trying to get back up to speed and then trying to find time to prep for this as well. So it's been a hectic week as always, but hopefully we can cumber up an hour worth of topics to talk about on today's session.
I'm sure
session.
We will.
How about you? How's your week been?
Yeah, good. It's been, to be honest, I'll say it while Phil's not here, I've been catching up on some I suppose like accounts that I've not spoken to in a while, and you know when you kind of realize how behind you are on a couple of certain things, it's just been a bit anxiety invoking. but it's been good. I feel like I'm getting on top of stuff, and then you know the second half of the week has been breathing down your neck to do some prep for the podcast and things, so yeah, it's been good, thanks. Lawrence has asked in the chat, is there any updates on the likelihood of the DPDI bill post-election status? So we were going to talk about this next, really. I've not seen anything apart from the fact that it's not being officially confirmed that it's dead or what's happening with it. So I think how it currently stands is that it's not being carried through in the wash up, but it could be resurrected by the new government or just dead. And I think we'll probably find that out at a later date, to be honest, as things are going at the moment. So yeah, no further than where we were last week, I think.
I second that. I've not seen anything concrete other than what that individual tweeted last week, so I think take that with a pinch of salt for now. But I've not seen anywhere that it's going to be taken up in the wash-up process. And I did see, I think it was PDP, on one of their newsletters, they said that if it's going to come to fruition, then it's going to have to be done. It's going to have to be bought up with the new new government. So, yes, nothing as of yet, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. What else have you seen in the news then, Joe? Put you on the spot.
Yeah, you do enjoy putting me on the spot, don't you?
like passing the baton.
You do. Yeah. Well. In a couple of days, a day and a half, I've not seen a great deal, but something that I did see was around the ICO launch an investigation, my AI chatbot investigation is a warning shot for the industry. So they concluded its investigation into Snap's launch of the My AI chatbot back in June 2023. The regulator opened an investigation into My AI following concerns that Snap had not met its legal obligation to adequately assess data protection risks posed by the new chatbot. The investigation led by the ICO issuing a preliminary enforcement notice in October. The ICO is now satisfied that Snap has now undertaken a risk assessment relating to My AI that is compliant with data protection law, saying that the investigation should act as a warning shot for the industry. So that's positive. I actually remember last year when that came about, I had some concerns around it. Do you know which one I'm referring to? It's Snapchat as opposed to Snap.
Yeah.
I had reservations about that.
I remember.
And I was actually able to kind of trip it up by saying, you know, do you know where I'm located? And it would say, no, we don't track your location. And then in the next question, I'd ask where the nearest McDonald's is. And it would say, oh, yes, there's one just around the corner from you. So yeah, I had reservations.
Dodgy.
Yeah, very dodgy, and I still don't think I'd fully trust it. I don't really use Snapchat these days. I think I've got one group chat in there, but that's the only real reason I use that. But yeah, absolutely dodgy. The chat has put in four or five things around the DPDI bill, I believe. So I wonder if it's just worth maybe picking through those before we move on. Ben said that, you know, he's asked, is there any EU deadlines coming out of transition periods which would prioritise the need for this to be completed and picked up where the government have left off?
Off the top of my head, there's the AI Act. I'm not sure when that is, but that's obviously something to be aware of, because it will affect, data protection, personal data moving forward. So I think there were previous issues with the bill, is that, you know, in terms of how closely it aligned with the EU AI Act, because, you know, it's going to be a very relevant piece of legislation, whether we're directly covered by it or not. You know, some organisations in the UK will be anyway, so there's got to be some sort of cooperation between the two. But I think that will affect things. And then Anne said, what, if anything, does Labour say about the DPDI bill? What changes might they make? And that's a really, really good question. I don't know if you've got any comments on that, Joe.
No, not really. Nothing concrete, really. I'm sure I've seen things kind of saying that they might be looking into maybe having like some sort of reform around data protection, but I don't want to, you know, start spreading rumours on here, so I'm going to say no, I've not seen anything.
That's the thing. I feel like something, you know, in the back of my head reminds me of seeing that Labour agreed with the DPDI bill, or at least in part, and this was some time ago, but it kind of just falls into that, you know, remit of Keir Starmer not really having a backbone, in my opinion. So I'm not sure how it will progress, but we'll see. Hopefully, you know, it's been recognised now as being controversial, probably unlawful in some ways, and we'll see what changes are made. Hopefully it's a complete overhaul.
Yeah, just to add to that, I've just done a quick search online, and don't know how much I trust this source, but you know, I thought I'd read it anyway. It says that despite not broadly opposing the DPDI bill, Labour have been relatively quiet on data protection reform. This is likely to mean amending GDPR will not be a high priority should a Labour government take office. However, Labour could actually seek to strengthen data protection laws. At their 2023 conference, Labour delegates committed the party to amend GDPR and Equality Act to guard against discriminatory algorithms. Labour have, however, been making a lot of noise around AI. In fact, they seem interested in deepening the UK's alignment with EU data regulations and pass the UK's own version of the recently enacted EU AI Act. So, yeah, doesn't really answer a question, does it? But by the sounds of that, it's not their top priority, but AI seems to be, in summary. I'll post a link to that article for anyone to have a read.
Matthew's put a link in the chat as well to an article saying that, you know, very bluntly, the DPDI bill is dead, long live the UK GDPR. And it says in it, you know, that it was, where is it now? So after 24 hours of speculation, it's now confirmed the DPDI bill has fallen in the House of Lords and will proceed no further. It is now an X bill. So I think this might relate to the post on LinkedIn and just on social media, really, by I forget his name, but one of the Lords in the House of Lords saying that you know, it's not going to be carried through. So I suppose that's the closest we've got to confirmation. But I'm surprised not to see anything, you know, on the Gov website and that kind of thing. So I think that's what I'm going to keep an eye out for anyway.
Yeah, sorry, I was just replying to Chris in the chat. Says he's never used Snapchat. Probably for the best, Chris.
Yeah. Now, I saw something in the news about the ICO, I suppose, posing some questions to Microsoft about its latest feature, the recall feature, Windows 11 recall feature. I'm not sure if anyone's heard of this. It basically enables users to always find a way back to information they previously reviewed by taking screenshots of everything that's happening on your computer or laptop every few seconds. So Microsoft's AI then makes all the information available within those screenshots for 3 months. So there's been a lot of concerns around this, you know, is Microsoft are going to be, I suppose, spying on you, you know, what the risks are around the security risks and so on. And I've seen, well, obviously the ICO has some questions as well, because, you know, it's posed those to Microsoft just to understand it a little bit more. But I thought in doing a bit of research around this, I found a really sassy article, which is how I'd like to put it, which basically starts off by saying, like, unless you've been living under a rock, you'll have heard about the Microsoft Recall feature. But it explains why, you know, people shouldn't be as concerned as they are, and in certain ways at least, you know, it says that it's not a bad thing to question things and you know, not to take on everything as face value, but at the same time, the reason why people are getting concerned, that there shouldn't really be a need for that. So I just thought I'd highlight a few of those points. Because, you know, even with these, it still does raise a few questions for me. But the first one being that Recall doesn't talk to the cloud, so it doesn't send information to Microsoft servers. Everything's stored locally on the computer. It is encrypted using device encryption and BitLocker. It works offline, so you don't need an active internet connection to take advantage of it. So it doesn't require a Microsoft account. And as a result, in missing some quality of life features such as cross-device syncing, none of that is possible here because Windows Recall doesn't upload your data anywhere. Microsoft doesn't train AI models on Windows Recall data. It can't be used to tailor ads and services in your favor for this reason. And it's optional at the end of the day as well. So it's worth keeping these things in mind because, you know, the first thing you think is where's your data going? What is it accessible? There are still risks, obviously, such as if someone was to, you know, get hold of your device if it was unlocked. So there might be space there in the future to, you know, add further measures such as a feature on the Recall app or something that only allows you to unlock it through the app, that kind of thing, like two-factor authentication and stuff. But yeah, it's an interesting move forward in technology, to be honest, and I'm still a bit reluctant. I don't know why. It does still feel like you're getting spied on, but I mean, it's not available on all laptops anyway yet. It's only those with Copilot on, PCs with Copilot, which is Microsoft's feature as well. So it's just something to watch out for.
Yeah, I agree. I wasn't familiar with Recall.
You've been living under a rock then, apparently.
Yeah, apparently so. and it raises alarms to me as well, Jasmine, even though, you know, as I've said, they've answered all these questions saying that it's encrypted, it's stored locally, no one can access it, it's not used for AI. It just still doesn't quite seem right. I don't understand where the desire as for this has come from. You know, have people reached out to Microsoft and said, oh, I'd love to have a functionality that allows me to go back and look at you know, everything that I've searched on my laptop over the last 3 weeks, 3 months, sorry. I just can't really understand. Or is it for organizations to be able to monitor staff and what they're doing on their devices? It just doesn't really sit right with me.
I never thought about that. That's a good point.
Yeah, and well, the only reason that's come to me really is because, well, Ben's left a comment in the chat saying that he'd like to see the privacy notice. So as you were explaining kind of what you know, what Recall is and the things they've got in place, I tried to find the privacy notice. I couldn't find one, but I did come across an article that says, here's 7 reasons why you shouldn't be worried, why you can stop worrying about Microsoft Recall. And that's
that's the one.
No. Oh, is that the one? Is it? Yeah.
You were clearly listening.
By ZNet, is it?
Maybe you found a different one.
Possibly, yeah.
Windows
just saying,
Central.
No, yeah, separate one then must be. But it just says you can turn this feature on or off during initial setup. Those screen captures are stored and processed locally. No one else can access the Recall data.
Yeah, I ran
data.
Through them, Joe.
They're the same ones, are they then? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very bizarre. But then point 6 was the point where it came from around staff monitoring. Though they said that your IT staff has ultimate control over Recall, which made me kind of think, okay, so then maybe this is kind of in like the sense that they're expecting employers to start using it and being able to kind of monitor staff kind of, yeah, you know, what they're doing on day to day. But then obviously that will open up a whole nother can of worms around risks and things like that, because that's, you know, that could have serious implications on data subjects, couldn't it, if it leads to you know, disciplinaries or potentially even people losing their jobs. So I don't know, it doesn't sit right with me either, to be honest with you, Jasmine, but I don't really think I have an answer.
No, it's a really good point, not about monitoring staff, because I think that's something that I think it comes up a lot, to be honest, just through what I see comes through our support desk and all sorts, like whether it's CCTV or, you know, what are they called, like black box monitoring on vehicles, which is something that I think people don't always realize is personal data, because they think they're, you know, monitoring the vehicle, but it's obviously the driver and driving styles. Michael's got his hand up.
I feel it's a very controversial piece, isn't it? Because sometimes I've had people, and this is something they say in the CIPPE training material, that there's been experiences of people trying to put sensors on desks, especially during COVID, to see if people are actually using them for hot desking measures. And then even the proposition that people use Teams through COVID as well, because the managers might be looking at them to see if they're available. But the fact you can set it to appearing online usually will counter that ever so slightly. But then, yeah, you could have some people trying to micromanage their employees with these solutions, or maybe using it. So why haven't you been at your desk for the last 2 weeks? Because the sensors coming up with it could make it very difficult, and it could become also an HR issue, right? Because they could, it's hard to say that it's actually really beneficial to the employee itself if you do it right.
I know it seems to be one that's, you know, you can see the why someone might like the idea of it for on an individual level, if they need to, you know, find old things that they've been searching for, or however you use it, really. But I think, you know, extending that past that, which probably will happen in some instances, it is something that definitely needs to be thought through carefully. I don't really see how that would happen, but I'm trying to think. You know,
it's always getting their opinion on things as well, but then the person might be pressured to give you a good opinion about whatever it is, because they feel their boss is going to, or they might cherry pick the only good feedback about the whole process for them. So, yeah, you're right. Yeah, how can we not be biased when going through that process as an organisation? Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose as well. It's an optional feature, isn't it? So would it be company policy to turn it on or to turn it off? Or there's two sides to it. You know, if an organization issues out laptops with, you know, that have Copilot on it, and I know that some organizations, you know, they already use Copilot, but with this option, would it be company policy to keep it on or to keep it off? And, you know, would then have to inform individuals of, you know, doing it at their own risk, really, if they want to use it, if they put it out to the staff, for example,
or you know, like the very good recording notes you give out at the beginning of this call, maybe they do something along those lines, so at least it's clear in writing that they can object to it being done, maybe. But then, are they actually going to be following it? Like, I saw some meetings online where people will ask the group and wait a minute or two for a response, but then you might have someone who joins in a few minutes late and doesn't know they're going through Copilot, maybe. So it can be a little bit tricky, can't it? It can't be 100%.
Yeah, there's risks as well, and concerns around, you know, other people's information. So you just said that example of, you know, I was putting that privacy notice on here, and I was just thinking about someone taking that and using it themselves. But what about then if you're talking with someone from an external company, or whether it's somebody internal, and you know you're having a conversation and it's storing that, then that other person might not be comfortable with that, and how do you manage that?
Yeah, they may not want to say anything, right? It could be a very serious HR situation, and they might not often have access, will they, as a contractor on Teams to the recording, so they might feel that their image or information's being stolen. I know it sounds a bit dire to say that, but for some people, their name is very, very, very important. The image is as well, sometimes culturally relevant. So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I remember reading in the article that, you know, it doesn't secretly, basically, you're always aware there's an icon on the bottom taskbar that says when the recall feature is actually active, but does it tell other people that, you know, if I was on a, say, Michael, you didn't want this to be obviously it's recorded anyway, but you didn't, if we was having a meeting or a call or whatever it was, or a conversation over email or Teams, and you know, you ask that to be deleted, then what happens with the screenshot? It's a lot to think about.
Sorry, go on, Michael.
Even your voice is biometric data, right? So I could potentially use it to access certain things if you had that as well. So, and sometimes people will change the wording. I mean, look at that famous case recently with that BBC reporter where her a video was made with Elon Musk promising to give out money to everybody. So her voice was manipulated and her image, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, obviously you wouldn't do that, but there might be someone who joins one of these calls or webinars who might try to use something like that. But what benefit would
be?
Please,
no one do that.
Yeah, but it's tricky, isn't it? Because actually then it starts being a detriment to privacy, because actually it's good that we're transparent and talking about everything without being put off by technology, but we just should put these controls in place. But it's all right, Joe knows everybody on this call, so I'm sure you'll find them if they decide to do anything dodgy, right, Joe? You can use your newspaper connections. That was a really good piece, by the way, on LinkedIn, by the way.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Jasmine, your point about it recording other people, you know, say for example you're on a Teams call, you're having a meeting about work, and you know they may not be aware, they're probably not going to be aware, I'd have thought. You're then obviously obliged, aren't you, as a data controller, to provide them with privacy information. And as a data controller, you know, you have the principles to follow, you have rights you need to consider as well. So, you know, does Microsoft Recall allow data controllers to be able to go into those snapshots and retrieve that data in order to fulfill rights requests that come your way? I'm not necessarily looking for an answer from you, but it's things that...
I assume so. I suppose, yeah, I assume so, because it stores it, you know, for you to look back at a later date. But, you know, it is just an absolute can of worms, and it's whether an organisation wants to open them. It's just hoping that they will actually consider these things beforehand, which I think is often more of an issue than, you know, knowing the issues and carrying on anyway. It just reminds me of WhatsApp and, you know, organizations' use of WhatsApp. I'm sure so many people on this call have tried to battle against it in their own organizations, and it can be impossible because, you know, whether it's an external organization that needs to that wants to use it, or a third party, you know, if it's a customer that only communicates through WhatsApp and, you know, you've not got a choice but to use it, it's then trying to find ways to keep it in check as much as possible. But it doesn't mean that it makes things, you know, that much easier at the same time.
Yeah, spot on, Jasmine. And I think organizations probably won't even be aware that there'll be data controllers of personal information when using things like Microsoft Recall. You're quite right. I think people will just go in for it and just say, yeah, we'll do this, and not think about the considerations or the potential risks that are at play.
Yeah. Well, hopefully not too many, because it puts me on edge a little bit, that thought of it. It's just, obviously, it's trying to raise awareness, isn't it, more than anything. But you get people who are, or organizations who are aware of data protection and their responsibilities, and then you get those that just have absolutely no clue. You know, luckily as it stands, the UK GDPR is here to stay for a little bit longer, so awareness raising can continue to grow, but without just completely changing everything. But it's work in progress, to say the least. Michael said in the chat that SARs are more complex when WhatsApp is taken into consideration. That is very true. Obviously, there's multiple things to consider, whether it's, you know, WhatsApp on someone's work phone or personal phone, what, you know, your organizational policy is around that. It can be a basket case, really.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just reading the article that Michael's just popped into the chat regarding deepfake videos that shows BBC presenters promote an alleged Elon Musk investment project. Sorry. Trying to keep up with the chat is a struggle in itself, isn't it? Have you seen anything else in the news?
On the topic of AI, I don't know if anyone has seen that the European Data Protection Board, to take it back a step, it's got a task force that is, you know, its purpose is to investigate ChatGPT, large language models, but, you know, seeing as though ChatGPT was the first that was publicly available to people, then it's decided to focus on that. And it has released a report on it. So it highlights, you know, the key areas that need to be taken into consideration with large language models. And I don't know if they've investigated based on, you know, publicly available information or how much they've conferred with ChatGPT, but from what I've read, you know, they don't have the answers. So I assume that it's publicly available information, and it highlights areas such as transparency, accuracy, lawful bases and rights, which I think if anyone, you know, here thinks about how ChatGPT or OpenAI comply with these things, then you can't really answer it. So it makes sense. And they've posed a few questions in there as well. I'll try and find a link to it, actually. They've posed a few questions to OpenAI, I suppose, to or for supervisory authorities to use to get the right answers in how OpenAI and ChatGPT complies with data protection legislation. So there was a post on LinkedIn. Let me try and find it. I think her name is Louisa Jarofsky. And she's I recommend following her, to be honest. She's really good for legislative updates, you know, across the world, really. And she posted it. I reshared it. Sorry, Mark, that's running really slow. But she raised the issue of legitimate interests. So I believe OpenAI rely on legitimate interests for the use of ChatGPT. And there's different processing activities. Obviously, there's you know, scraping the internet for responses. So that's the output, the input that goes into it, and how it uses this information to train its models. And one of the things around legitimate interests is transparency. And you know, if you are relying on that, then you need to make people aware that you're relying on it and how. You know, one of the issues being is that ChatGPT, for one, doesn't make its information publicly available as to how it collects data and, you know, provide what information it puts out as well. There's all sorts of questions. So it's strange that the ICO, the European Data Protection Board have, I suppose, gone down that route of saying how, you know, you can facilitate legitimate interests when they're not doing that. But maybe it's, you know, it's only the start of this investigation. So it'll give OpenAI a chance to respond to, you know, to these questions. But I'd be really intrigued to see if it can.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, for last week's podcast session, when we were doing the prep for the AI session, I kind of put myself, I guess, I don't know whose shoes I was in, really. I was kind of just asking the questions as like, as ChatGPT, as a data controller, you know, how do they comply with the data protection principles? And I guess that's kind of what you were inferring to there. And, you know, I don't know if it's kind of just worth going through it now together, you know, on this session, just knock some ideas around, just kind of building on what you've said there about, you know, they're asking questions around, you know, if they rely on legitimate interest, that's fine, but you have to be able to issue, you know, you have to be transparent, you have to issue privacy information. But then what if they start collecting special category data, because then they'll obviously need an additional Article 9 lawful basis, you know, which would be the most appropriate there. Looking at things like purpose limitation obviously requires you to, you know, only collect data for specific, explicit, legitimate purposes and not further process in a manner that is incompatible with those purposes. You know, is collecting public data to evolve AI chat models that could in turn result in people losing jobs considered to be in the public's interest? Possibly not. So obviously the principle further states that, you know, further processing for archiving purposes in public interest, scientific or historical research purposes, you know, would not be considered compatible with the initial purposes. So you're right, there's a lot to kind of consider, isn't there, around, you know, ChatGPT and OpenAI models similar to that, as to whether they actually comply with data protection principles, and if so, are they demonstrating this? Because obviously, once you work your way through the principles, you come to accountability, and obviously the organization is, you know, they're accountable for demonstrating compliance with the other principles, and I don't think so far they're doing that.
Yeah. Another point as well, you know, in line with what you're saying there, is on anonymization on Louise's post here. So, you know, they've got a duty to ensure that only minimal data is processed, that it's accurate, and things like that. And I don't, you know, they've provided no reassurance that that is the case. And, you know, there's evidence to show that it's not accurate all the time and whatnot. They're not anonymizing personal data, as the system still outputs information about people. But she's made a point to say as well that they're closing various licensing deals with websites such as Reddit and other platforms that contain personal data. So, you know, obviously they're not avoiding the use of personal data, and it doesn't seem like they plan to do so either. So, yeah, I think this report will be really useful to, you know, to really apply the pressure on OpenAI and, you know, similar large language models or their creators.
Yeah, on data accuracy, I was actually doing a bit of research on that, trying to kind of understand, you know, how you comply with that. And in practice, the ICO says that, you know, you must take reasonable steps to ensure the accuracy of any personal data, ensure that the source and status of personal data is clear, carefully consider any challenges to the accuracy of information, and consider whether it's necessary to periodically update the information. Now, I don't know about you, but it just doesn't seem possible that, you know, organizations such as OpenAI would be doing these steps when they're scraping such large quantities of data off of, you know, publicly available information. And it just doesn't really seem feasible for them to do that. And I did some further research, and the ICO went on to say that the UK GDPR does not define the word accurate. However, the Data Protection Act 2018 does say that inaccurate means incorrect or misleading as to any matter of fact. It will usually be obvious whether personal data is accurate. If inaccurate personal data is collected from online sources and is used to provide answers to individuals using the platform, then this would constitute a breach of this principle due to misleading information being provided. Now, we know currently that ChatGPT, although I'm not sure kind of how it stands now, but previously it was, you know, providing inaccurate answers. It was providing information to people that was not correct. So I just don't really see why it's not been an issue previously, kind of around, you know, the accuracy of the data they're using. Is it maybe because it's not necessarily personal data that's inaccurate, as opposed to, you know, just data in general around things?
I don't know.
Maybe that's why.
Because I think on that point, you know, it depends what you're asking it, really. I've not really asked it questions about people specifically, but I couldn't tell you. I'm going to try after this, actually, and see, you know, what responses it comes back with. I don't know how much I'd be able to verify it or not, but we can have a play around with it at least. But yeah, I think it does provide inaccurate data, so it, regardless, the risk is there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, and you know, it just could lead to, you know, further issues in terms of inaccurate data that's being kind of knocked around. It's still a risk, maybe not a data protection risk. But yeah, wider than that, I think.
I wonder, you know, on, say, the topic of deep fakes, if, so obviously you can use AI to generate videos or whatever it is on celebrities, for example. And, you know, it's not true. It's just generated. So
yeah.
Would you say that that's an issue around accuracy or not? Because it's intentional. That, I suppose, that individual could complain and say, you know, this isn't a real representation or what, but I feel like that's a whole different kettle of fish as well, you know, on top of these large language models.
Yeah, just thinking about it, it's a very good point. And I was just then mulling over the kind of idea that if it's inaccurate and it's not really them, is it them? But you can identify them from it, so then it would still constitute their personal data, wouldn't it? Even though it's not a real image. So yeah, absolutely. I don't really see how that's able to kind of stand, and how it occurs is, to me, off, you know, my first kind of thought around that would be that it's, how is that lawful? I don't know.
I suppose it's in, you know, in what context it's used for, because if somebody is, you know, using it to play.
You mute yourself.
Someone's muting me. Weird. That's thrown me off now. What was I saying?
Don't know. So I was like, well, this one, will Jasmine please stop talking?
I know, I'm sorry to offend, but maybe it's AI.
Yeah, you don't have to be here, guys, if you don't want to listen to us.
Anyway, I can't remember what I was saying, so sorry. But yeah, I thought I'd raise, I don't know if you've seen in the news that the Council of Europe has adopted the first international treaty on AI.
I've not seen that. No.
No. So I believe it's called the Council of Europe Framework Convention on Artificial Intelligence and Human Rights, Democracy and the Rule of Law. And it was adopted in Strasbourg during the annual ministerial meeting of the Council of Europe's Committee of Ministers. And according to the official release, the treaty, which is also open to non-European countries, sets out a legal framework that covers the entire life cycle of AI systems and addresses the risks they may pose while promoting responsible innovation. So the convention adopts a risk-based approach to design, development, use and decommissioning of AI systems, which requires carefully considering any potential negative consequences of using the AI systems. It covers the use of AI systems in the public sector, including companies acting on behalf, on its behalf and in the private sector. The convention offers parties two ways of complying with its principles and obligations when regulating the private sector. Parties may opt to be directly obliged by the relevant convention provisions, or as an alternative, take other measures to comply with the treaty's provisions while fully respecting their international obligations regarding human rights, democracy and rule of law. So yeah, that's an interesting one. I don't know who has signed up to this. I don't know what the UK's involvement is in it, and you know, other organisations, other countries outside of the EU, but it's one to keep an eye on anyway.
Yeah, it's a step in the right direction, isn't it? It's, you know, it's another kind of safeguard around AI and the potential risks, and it's good to see that things are kind of, you know, now starting to progress through different governments, and you know, new things are starting to kind of appear that's kind of going to govern AI. But I guess the kind of worry for me around all this is that, can the legislation that's coming around AI keep up with AI itself? Because we know how quick AI develops and how quickly it learns and it starts to kind of branch off, and there's new things coming everywhere that kind of, as I know, to me it just feels like we're never really going to keep up with AI. And I think that's where probably the biggest risk lies, is kind of the unknown around it, and kind of while we're sat here trying to, you know, write up acts and sign treaties around the use of AI currently right now, that may not align with what it could look like in 2-3 years time.
Yeah, I think with AI, people are going to, you know, gradually, especially as people grow up, and, you know, younger generations who have grown up around technology their whole lives and are much more comfortable with it, will, you know, they'll grow up and start making the rules and stuff as well. People will just naturally get more used to it and incorporate it more into normal life. I think obviously it feels a bit rushed in with some pieces of legislation like the EU AI Act, but I think it's still absolutely necessary. You know, you've still got to make an attempt to try and keep on top of it and regulate it. It absolutely needs regulation. But I think at the same time, it's going to be amended and amended and amended, you know, whilst we get more of an understanding of the power of AI as well. You know, there's still questions around that and then how it's used as well.
Yeah, it's a good point, that, Jasmine. I mean, there's no better time to start than now, is there? So, you know, it's out there. Something has to be in place, otherwise it will just go, you know, AWOL. So it's definitely, you know, the right thing that they're doing. It's I don't know, AI just worries me a little bit.
A little bit. I saw something about ChatGPT the malware thing. What could you tell me about that?
I did see something, but I don't know if I've made a note of it anywhere. So no. I don't think I'll be able to, unfortunately.
It about its coding, malware coding or something. Am I ringing any bells?
Yeah, I did find an article on that, but I don't think I made a note of it. So let me see if I can find it. Sorry, guys, this is very it's very poor from myself, isn't it?
Don't worry about it. We'll just move on to something else. Do you want to talk about the ICO's guidance to individuals on, you know, with the general election coming up?
Yes. Yeah. I noticed on LinkedIn, I think it was, I saw someone had a comment around some guidance that the ICO put out in relation to, you know, the use of personal data in the general election. So I went and had a read of the blog. It was actually quite useful. I thought it was, you know, pretty good. It had some really good information kind of around what you should expect from political campaigners, what you can expect on election day, and what you can even expect from the ICO. And part of the blog provides an explanation around kind of, you know, what you can expect former, new and returning MPs to handle your data appropriately. And it said that as well as the usual turnover of MPs, this general election will see some changes to constituency boundaries so that you may find you are now resident of a different constituency. Sorry, any MP who is stepping down, is not re-elected, or whose constituency boundary is changing will be managing the transfer of constituents, casework and data. Therefore, if you have an ongoing recent case with your current MP, they may contact you to ask for your consent to share your data with your new MP. You should be aware that if you do not grant this consent, the data or casework may be deleted. And the post that I saw on LinkedIn kind of raised the question around whether consent would be the most appropriate lawful basis. And I kind of had to kind of agree to that kind of, I don't know, my initial thoughts was that consent, I don't know, I don't think consent would necessarily work for that. I mean, I kind of get the logic behind it, but the bit at the end of that guidance where it says that you should be aware that if you do not grant this consent, the data or casework may be deleted. That to me is kind of saying that I think people will see that and think, great, okay, so I'm in a bit of a conundrum here. I don't really want to pass my information on to the new MP, for example. If my constituency is Labour, Conservatives come in, I don't like Conservatives, I don't want them to deal with my issues, but the constituency is changing. I don't really have a choice here. Otherwise, you know, if I want my case to be resolved, I either have to consent to that or it will get deleted. That was my interpretation of it anyway. So please do correct me, you know, if I've taken that way off. But to me, that would then in turn force the individual into making a decision or to consent into it because they want a resolution. So then, you know, that's not really a free choice, in my opinion.
Yeah, I suppose it's a good point. I suppose it's when, you know, at what point is, I don't know, to be honest. I feel like I was going to answer that and it doesn't make sense to that point. I was going to say when the, you know, when is the consent collected? So what awareness do they have of, you know, who that data is going to be going to? I've just been trying to keep up with the chat at the same time and it's going off on one though, so it's a bit tricky.
Yeah. Is it relating to this or is it separate? I did see it popping up.
Separate.
Okay. I kind of want to build on this before we go back to the chat.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Sorry, what was the question you asked? The chat put me off as well. It's kind of around like when's the data collected sort of thing, or when's the consent collected, sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine it's when they're aware that it's being moved across. So like, for example, I was an MP of Labour, you're a Conservative, I've got all this casework, I've lost my seat. At that point, I will have to reach out to the data subjects and say, look, you know, I've lost my seat. Jasmine's going to be taken over. She's a Tory MP. You know, do I have your consent to pass your casework over? So I guess that's at the point of where the consent will be collected.
Yeah, it's a hard one. I don't know what else. Because I suppose, you know, within that, there's possibly special category data if it's alluding to, you know, their political beliefs potentially.
could you say public task or public interest?
It could be. It probably depends on the situation, you know, if it's a personal complaint or it's something or some change that they want to see in their community. Lawrence has got his hand up.
Just on the MP issue, is it really the person that they're electing or the post, in the sense of if I have an MP, I mean, unless it's something very specific, if a new person comes into the post, is it really the person or is it the post that they're inhabiting when for this approval?
Yeah.
Good question. I suspect the post, but part of the post will, you know, the post will be your area, won't it? So you'll be looking after everyone within that. So say, I don't know, I don't know how granular it goes in Yorkshire, but I'm from Derby originally, so they have like MPs for like Erewash and then like separate little areas. So I presume when you become an MP of that area, you'll be responsible for all those people, will you not? So then all the casework that kind of links towards that, you'll then kind of maybe have to take over that casework. I guess that's kind of what they're asking here, right? That they want the approval of the individual that they're okay to pass the information on to the new MP. Is that the question he's kind of answering, Lawrence? I want
political. Yeah, that's it. I'm sorry, yeah. That answered it. Sorry, I've got to go on another call. I do apologize.
That's all right. No worries.
Thanks for coming.
So,
think on that point, though, you know, it's say I'm thinking of this in the context of, you know, they're not happy with how something is, you know, a current situation, whether it's, for example, the youth centres, they're all getting closed down and they want to change that, you know, they want funding for that. That issue probably doesn't change regardless of whose responsibility it is to pick it up. So, you know, if Labour and Conservatives or if the Green Party get in this time, if they regardless of what their manifesto is and what changes they want to implement and you know, just their attitudes, then that complaint or that suggestion remains the same, and it's up to them as to how they respond to that. So, you know, maybe it's just worth looking at from a different angle.
Yeah, so what you're saying by that is that consent you don't think consent's kind of like most appropriate, because MPs, regardless of who they're working under, would have a duty to, you know, resolve these queries.
Not necessarily. It's more from the point of, you know, whether it's freely given, whether you want that to be, because at the end of the day, you know, it shouldn't. Obviously, you vote for who you want to be, you know, running your constituent and whatnot. But regardless of who's in play in post, then you want this specific change. So you're going to you want to consent if you want to see that change, regardless of how it's implemented or who implements it. Not so much how it's implemented, because, you know, if you specify how you want that change to come, then, you know, that doesn't change. But
yeah, I hear you. But what if, like, then that take an individual that's, you know, really, really on one side of the, you know, political, say you're very much Labour, you hate Conservatives, you don't want to deal with Tory MPs, but you want this query to be answered. You're not really being given a choice, are you? Because
yeah, but
that MP is taking over regardless. You either consent to it being passed across, or your case is probably going to get deleted and you're not going to have any sort of resolution.
Well, the thing is, though, you might be bitter about the fact that the party is in post that you don't like and you don't want, but there's still a reason why you like, you know, the other party, and it's those kind of changes that you want to come, so you can still push for those changes regardless of what party it is. I suppose it's a different problem whether you like them or not compared to what you want.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like, it's,
yeah,
whether they implement it or not, you know, that's a different problem. But
I still don't think you're being really given a free choice, though. Take out whether you like them or not, then just say, okay, so that information has to get passed on for the case to be resolved, otherwise it's going to get deleted. It's not giving you a free choice to say yes or no, is it, really? Because the two options are you either do it or you don't, and if you don't, then you're not really going to get a resolution.
Yeah, but that is your choice. you decide to withdraw. That's just the nature of the cycle, isn't it? There's not really much you can do to prevent that. You can't have the first MP to, you know, continue the case because they're not in that position anymore, or the
okay,
party.
Okay, I guess so. Yeah. So, all right. Yeah, but okay. That's why I just think legitimate interest would just make most sense, though, just to, because it's in the interests of both the person and the MP to resolve all casework.
Yeah, but whether it's special category data, you know, it's related to someone's political opinions, then you might need explicit consent anyway. So consent, you know, is the way probably.
Okay.
We settled the debate.
I was gonna go further, but I've chosen not to.
Okay. Maybe for the best.
It's definitely for the best. Yeah, because I was gonna start talking about like substantial public interest, but you know, that'll be a case by case basis, won't it? So it's your best to cover it, you know, as an umbrella, aren't you? And have one lawful basis for the, because you go too granular, you're just creating yourself so much work, aren't you? So
yeah.
Yes, I will resign defeat and agree that consent is probably the most appropriate.
I mean, if I'm wrong, you know, prove me wrong, anyone in the chat as well. I can't think of, because there is a political lawful basis in under Article 9 for special category data. But that's within
the party itself.
Yeah, within the party itself. And if you want to share it outside of the party, then you need consent anyway. So, you know, all roads lead to consent in this instance. But I've got a question for you anyway. So imagine you're a council and it emerges that you've posted by accident the names, addresses and contact details of 156 people onto your website for 11 months time. You know, would you say that's a reportable breach?
Wait to put me on the spot. I'm going to give you an answer and it's not going to be one you like. It's going to be the devil's in the detail.
Okay. So it's, let me find it here. So it's personal details of residents who commented on a planning application on its website. So these were, you know, on the website by accident for 11 months. Like I said, names, addresses, contact details. Well, this council, I think I can name it, it's publicly available information, Lewisham Council, decided not to report this breach. And the reasons being that there wasn't any special category data involved and the data was in the public domain for 11 months. So, you know, with no reporting, so of any adverse effects.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably why they... What did they do? Did they report it or did they not?
No.
Okay. So I guess maybe their probably thought process behind that is that it's been up there for 11 months and nothing's kind of happened. So they probably took that stance. Although you could say on the other hand that just because something's not happened doesn't mean that it won't. And that, you know, just because it's not visibly known to you that nothing's happened, so you know this, nothing's been reported, no harm's kind of occurred for now, doesn't mean that that data has been taken and sold, you know, for example. So I don't know, 11 months is quite a long time, isn't it, for data to be on somewhere. And I think the longer that data is available to people that it shouldn't be, the greater the risk, I'd probably say. Would you agree?
Say that last bit again, I was just reading the chat.
I said the longer the data is made available to the wrong people, you know, on the website for 11 months, the longer it's kind of in the public domain, the higher the risk, or, you know, the more the risk will grow, I'd say.
Yeah, I think yes and no. You know, it leaves you open for a longer period of time, so naturally that obviously increases the risk. But then at the same time, if something's been there for so long, as time goes on, you know, if that was to happen and you saw it within a day, there'd be panic because you don't know what would come from it. If the dust has settled and, you know, it's been there for so long, then maybe not in that sense. But I suppose, in my opinion, it's quite a controversial one, and not necessarily wrong at all. I don't think it's wrong. I understand the justification, but at the same time, there are always two ways to look at something. And in this instance, I think, yeah, the risk might be minimal. Are they fully aware of all of the risks? You know, have they done a full risk assessment? Sometimes, you know, scale doesn't matter. If it's one person that is affected, that doesn't mean that it's any less risky to that one individual. But there are 156 people here that have been affected. And names, addresses and contact details together. Someone says in the chat, you know, you can probably find this information elsewhere. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case, you know, for everyone. I don't know if, hopefully you can't find my address, you know, that kind of thing. So, that doesn't necessarily mean that there is no risk there. And because it's been publicly available and because it's, you know, clearly it's in the news, so it's somewhat a high profile case, surely you would just provide some reassurance, you know, in the public, in these individuals, that you are taking it seriously and you would report it to the ICO. Because I don't know, I just think that would be a best practice kind of approach, whether the threshold is met or not.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, Jasmine. There's a lot to kind of unpack, isn't there? And as you mentioned, that just because it's, you know, possibly available elsewhere doesn't necessarily mean that there's no risk. But it is quite low level stuff. You know, what can you really do with somebody's name, contact details, address? You can go around to the house. You could pass that information on to people. I guess the more you think about it, the more you can open the can of worms, can't you? That, you know, there could be someone on there with their address that's potentially running away from, you know, a domestic abuse case. And then obviously that could then in turn result in a risk. But, you know, how likely is that? Probably quite unlikely, but you don't know, do you? So it's, we always say, don't we, in worst case scenarios, kind of, you know, take the approach that you report it and then, you know, you've done your duty, haven't you? And there's nothing else more that you can do. So, yeah, tricky one. And I don't think I have an answer for you, I don't think.
Yeah, I think most people in the chat are agreeing. Christopher, sorry, sometimes the name's the wrong way around. I was going to call you Thompson then. Christopher said there could be some personal data in the comments of the planning application, which is true. That's something that I see a lot actually in breach forms, you know. So say our process on the support desk or through our DPOs, if one of our customers receives a breach, we'll send over a breach form, ask them to complete it and, you know, send it back, we'll review it, or we'll just go through it with them, etc. And a lot of the time, you know, it'll be like comments in something that probably do have personal data in it, that aren't, you know, they're not recorded, people don't recognize them as personal data. They'll put the email address and, you know, the name and that kind of thing. But say, for example, an email, yeah, and it's the content of the email that they don't really consider that to be personal data. And it's, it's usually where the most risky information can be.
Yeah, certainly.
Shane said breach of confidentiality in relation to reasonable expectation of the 156 data subjects, duty of care with advice to data subjects to be aware of increased potential for contact through unsolicited email and contact details such as email phishing. Exactly, you know, as well as, you know, that duty of care, it's from the organization's perspective a reputational thing as well. You know, you want to, like I said earlier, instill faith in people that you are taking, you know, you do take these things seriously. So
you better take a risk-based approach, aren't you? So, you know, I think if you're unsure, the best thing to do, I think, is just to report it, because I think that's the most logical thing to do and in line with a risk-based approach, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think in this case, though, that they thought that, you know, they were sure, because I do get it, you know, it's been on for 11 months, no reports, but maybe those individuals don't actually know that it came from that. And in this instance, maybe they did notify the 156 people just to say, you know, just so you know, this has happened, etc. But at the same time, you know, the ICO, it's, it's in the news, you know what I mean? It's in the public domain. The ICO will have an eye on it potentially. So just do it.
I think so, yeah.
Maybe just, you know, some people and subsequently organizations are scared to be on the ICO's radar, which I do understand. At the same time, the ICO, I mean, we do bash them a lot on this, that they don't, you know, they don't come down on you and you know, just throw out the fines for nothing. They do. We can kind of predict, you know, what they'll say ourselves, can't we? And usually it's just some advice on what you need to do to improve. Case closed.
The argument about not being on the ICO's radar, though, is null and void, isn't it, when you say, oh, we don't want to report it because we don't want to be on their radar. But then if you don't report it and then someone reports you, then you're on the radar regardless. So the best thing to do is to report it. And because if you report it in line with the 72-hour threshold, you know, that you've done what you've meant to do. Like, I think people, like you say, get scared and they're like, oh, we don't want to report that because we don't want them to know. But you know, these things happen. The ICO is saying you're not allowed to have a personal data breach. They're saying where you do, you must report it to us unless it's unlikely to result in a high risk. So I just, people, yeah, it doesn't restrict you. The GDPR doesn't restrict you from doing anything, doesn't stop anything. It just says if something happens, it sets out requirements of what you need to do to, you know, to meet the, you know, the guidance and requirements of law. So it's, people get worried for no reason. I get it to an extent, but you know, Chris says there in the last comment of the chat saying that, you know, err on the side of caution and notify, and I completely agree.
Yeah, likewise. Well, that was a nice little summary. Thanks, Joe. thank you, everyone, for joining. You know, it's been over an hour now, so we'll have to wrap things up and get back to fun daily working life, but or lunchtime. thank you, everyone, for joining. We'll be back next week for a session on FOIA, Freedom of Information, Freedom of Information Requests. Myself and Joe won't actually be here. Whether you know, well, that person who kept muting me is probably happy about that, but it will be with Phil and Laura. So yeah, switching things up a bit, it should be a good session. But in the meantime, have a good weekend and thanks for joining.
Cheers, guys.
See you later.